This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need. From athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
Where's Fielder?
He's gone to the dogs.
Well, welcome, folks, to the Gone to the Dogs podcast. Your host, Steve Fielder, with you one more time. So grateful for the opportunity to visit with you each week on this podcast. We got to thank Al Gore for inventing the internet. Ha ha. And making it possible for us to stream these podcast sessions out there to you all across the country and even around the world, if you can imagine that. Today, I want to thank, first of all, before we go any further, my dear friends at DU Hunting Supply, W Hunting Supply out there in Washington State, Buddy Woodbury, Jason Doobie, all the staff out there for providing me this opportunity. And guys, if you need anything for your hounds, your hunting activities, and all, these guys have it. They got a great website. It's very easy to get on there, dusupply.com. And they absolutely service what they sell and have customer service that I think is second to none. Well, I'm really excited today to bring to the mic a guy that I've known for quite a while. I first met him when I went to work for PKC. We may have met at the UKC Winter Classic in Albany, Georgia, when I was a UKC man. I'm not sure, and we'll clear that up. But at any rate, I'm just really happy to have this guy here, Mr. Mark Israel from Smithfield, Georgia. How are you doing, Mark?
Hey, I'm fine, Steve, and I hope you're doing well.
I am. As the old saying is, much better than I deserve, for sure. Gee, it's good to have you on the podcast. I know you and I have talked a little bit on the phone in preparation for this, but I know you're a busy man, and it's kind of harvest season down there in Georgia, isn't it?
It is. Peanuts and cotton and soybeans are being harvested right now. Yeah,
and you do quite a bit of farming. That's kind of your day job, isn't it?
It is. Yes, it is. That among a few other things.
Well, I talked with you a little bit there, and you told me you're running a farm supply business, and that's there, aren't you, as your parents, like all of us, unfortunately. I've lost my parents, but you're fortunate enough to still have yours.
Well, there is about to turn 91, but my father's declining, and a few years ago I took the business over, actually for no compensation, and at that time, but I didn't know it would last this long. And then I farmed my father's farm for him, and then I farmed. It changes every year, 1,200-1,500 acres, maybe, you know, for my own income.
I got you. It's kind of like podcasting. It sounds like I do this every week, but so far I haven't gotten the first check. I'm still waiting on that one.
If I may bring up one thing.
Absolutely.
Before this thing goes too far, I really appreciate you asking me to be a guest, and I wouldn't know why anyone would want to hear anything I had to say, but there's something else I want to mention. You are one of a kind, and
thank God.
You're one of a kind in the hound and hunting world. To my knowledge, there's nobody else like you. And an icon to people like me.
You've managed to
stay involved with several different registries and promote coon hunting nonstop for how many years?
Well, it's been a long time, but I first started, I guess, down that professional path back in 1978 as a field rep for UKC, and then went there full time in 1983. So pretty much 11, and then writing and doing the podcasting. But you're very kind. I appreciate that, Mark, very much. You know, I wanted to talk to you because you have got a story that we're going to get into here in just a little bit. I'm going to stick my neck out here. I think you have a story that no other coon hunter could tell. And that's why I brought you, not really the only reason, because you have been a very active coon hunter, an influential coon hunter, a leader. And I want to talk about all that. But the story that we're going to share with our listeners in just a little bit, I think, is, as you listeners see the title of this podcast, they're going to know a little bit about what we're talking about. But you come from a part of the country there in southwest Georgia. Is that right?
Yes, sir. I do. Six generations of us right here.
Right there in the same place where you are now. And that's
My family walked in here and settled and made treaties with the Indians, believe it or not.
Isn't that amazing? That's amazing. You know, I digress here just a little bit. When I came to that part of the country for the first time was when I was with UKC. Of course, I'd driven through Georgia, but mainly it was through southeast Georgia, coming down Highway 301 or 321 or whatever, going to Florida from my home in West Virginia. But I came to that kind of generally that part of the world the first time when we started the UKC Winter Classic in Albany, Georgia. And that's east of you. How far are you from Albany?
About 30 miles.
Yeah.
I'm about 30 miles north of Albany, 26 miles.
Yeah, I gotcha. So it was a classic coon hunt in the Deep South, or the Old South, I think we said, because I was just taken by the history there, the beautiful, beautiful plantations, the homes that were just incredible. And I just fell in love with the area, honestly, from the first time that Fred Miller and I flew in there and went with Becky Salimi of the Chamber of Commerce and drove out to the community center in South Daugherty County there, their community center, and saw that. And Fred said, as we drove down that tree-lined drive, he said, "This is the spot, Steve. I think we found it." And I agreed. We meet when I was at the UKC, or was that later when I went to PKC?
You know, I knew who you were when you were with PKC, but I'm not sure. I'll be honest. I'm not sure if we ever met. I met so many people as I became a board member with PKC and state president. But I know at that point in time, there was a
scene. Oh, yeah.
And no one wanted, and PKC wanted to upset UKC. When y'all had the Winter Classic in Albany, the PKC held a hunt in Thomasville called the Sunshine Jamboree, and
correct.
And we always avoided that date, whatever date we'd wait for the UKC to set their date, and then we would set ours a week or so later, or maybe earlier, but most of the time later. And when I was elected president, the first meeting I was at, with some of my friends and LaVann Kennedy and Craig Hart.
Yeah, LaVann.
Nick Albison.
Right.
Steve Parrish, Woody McCoy. Fortunate enough to be friends with some men that were great sportsmen.
And, absolutely.
And owned powerful, powerful hounds. There was a point in time when this little area in Georgia, we had a two-time national leading female and a two-time national champion, you know, right here in my yard. But we held a meeting and we were talking about it, and they said, well, the Winter Classic is set their date on top of, you know, when we usually have our hunt. And I had just become the state president for Georgia. I had just been elected. And my first move, after talking to some of my closest friends, I said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do, y'all. When I go to the World Winter Classic, and we're going to advertise it as a chance for hunters to hunt the nights that they can't hunt in the Winter Classic, come hunt with us. And I said, actually, it's going to probably make the UK ad, because my first board of directors meeting was held under a tent in Aurora, Kentucky, and it was pouring rain. And Woody McCorkle, who had been the state president for the entire time PKC was here, I mean, it was, when I took over, you know, I wouldn't say it was in its infancy, but it hadn't been around very long. And I sat down at that table with Mr. Roy Tramble and Jarvis, and I told him that I was going to put the Sunshine Jamboree on top of the Winter Classic. And I thought Mr. Jarvis is going to flip that table over. He said, man, we just can't do that. We don't want to start a war. And I told him, you know, after a few minutes of me convincing them, you know, they decided to go along with it. And really good thing for UKC and for PKC. Maybe UKC lost a few guys, you know, but.
Well, I'll speak to that there in just a minute.
In my eyes, in my opinion, it turned out to be a great thing for UKC and PKC, and especially the coon hunters, who, that was kind of, when I went into office, I did everything I could to make things better for the average hunter. You know,
sure, sure.
Most pro hunters, they at that point in time, they had somebody, you know, backing them financially. And so I worked, everything I did was for the average, everyday coon hunter right. that went to open events. And I think that one move made things a lot easier for everyone.
Well, it certainly worked out. And yes, I'm sure that we weren't all that excited probably when we heard about that. But I will say, you mentioned Woody McCorkle. And, you know, putting together a hunt like the Winter Classic requires, and as you know, with the Sunshine Jamboree, requires quite a guide network, and you've got to have a lot of help. And right away, the UKC Winter Classic started drawing a great number of people from the north to come down to the Southland, you know, at a time of year when it was all iced in up there. And also, we did, you know, we kind of did the same thing. We wanted to have a hunt to compete with the Grand American, which was an AKC and ACHA, I guess, maybe. Corkle was a guy that always, as long as I was associated with UKC and at the Winter Classic each year, he always provided me five guides, always. You could set your watch by the man with the little fedora hat that's going to come walking up and say, "I got you five tonight, Steve." I didn't ask him for 10. I didn't ask him for 15. He told me he could provide me five. He always provided me five guides. And I loved Woody. He was a great guy. I really was saddened when I heard that he had passed away. And so he was just an example of the of a lot of, you mentioned LeVan Kennedy. LeVan was the guy that I worked with right away in getting guides together for the Winter Classic, you know, and went out and hunted with LeVan the first year that I was there. And just so many people, you know, you can't put, my dad used to tell me, he said, he was, of course, my dad was a union pipe fitter, you know, and he and I always had discussions about that. But he told me, he'd always say, "There's no one man automobile factory, Steve." And I'd, you know, and I'd say, "Yeah, but without that guy that puts his signature on the line, you know, to build that plant or whatever, you're not going to have a job." And around and around we go, you know. And I got a lot of friends that are in union, so I don't want to start that war here. But at any rate, my dad would say that to me. Well, that is true when you're putting on a major coon hunt. You know,
it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work, and it's a vast volunteer army of people that come together to make it happen. I just saw PKC was thanking all the guides and judges and everybody who helped put on their recent world hunt in Salem.
World hunt.
And, you know, and it absolutely is. It's, you can't say enough about those people who leave their dog at home, don't get a chance at all those prizes and trophies and that 8 minutes of fame or whatever, you know, just so we can go out there and have a good time. So
that's,
I'm glad
exactly
you brought that
right.
up. Yep. Yep. For
it
sure.
It was hard work. I actually guided for the Winter Classic for a couple of years before, maybe three before we, actually I guided for a year before I ever coon hunt, before I ever actually started competition hunting myself.
I see.
And then, I mean, it was kind of a whirlwind for me. Nick Alverson, I don't know. Nick Alverson, which I had a lot of really, really, we had a close-knit group of hunters here. Paul Sheffield. Hmm. Every time he and I went somewhere, Paul and I roomed together. And Nick Alverson, Buzz Register, Dennis Griffin, Steve Parrish, I know I won't name them all, but we were a close-knit group. But Nick in particular, he helped me when I started. Nick helped me become accepted. Coon hunters, or at least in this part of the world, something they're a little bit cliquey. And Nick slid me right in to become accepted. And then within a year, probably within a year of that, I was a state president for PKC. It all happened in a hurry. I was accepted, and people trusted me and believed in me. And actually, they, after I became the president, I mean, there was an election, but nobody even looked to see. Everybody had so much faith in me that I never even thought nobody ran against me. And it was that way all the way up to the day I resigned. Guys, I love every one of them.
Sure, sure. Well, none of us would be here without the help of our friends, and especially coon hunting friends, means so much. Okay, yeah. Mark, now you grew up on a farm, I'm assuming. Your dad's a lifelong farmer, right?
Yes, sir.
What are some of your earliest memories of growing up as a farm kid in Southwest Georgia?
Hard work, mostly pulling weeds. And my father didn't believe in an entitlement. I was young, but there was five of us, and we all pulled weeds and picked up pecans, and there were no cell phones. I remember we had pecan trees, on some of these farms. And in the fall, my father and mother load us up in trucks and give us all a coffee can and a crocus sack. And they'd go put us out in a pecan grove and go home. Daddy would go to the farm and mama would go home. And there were no cell phones or any means of contact. And some of those places were remote. And they put us out. And when they come back, they expected us to have a crocus sack full of pecans. But most of it was just hard work. I mean, a lot of physical labor. And actually, my mother taught me to be a shotgunner. Shooting does is a tradition in this part of the world.
Oh, yeah.
And my father was always so wrapped up trying to run a farm and a farm supply and building a world for five kids, hunting, and taught me deer hunting. I had to learn on my own because the first deer season I was of age, and I was self-taught at that. But my mother actually taught me to be a shotgunner, and I killed my first dove sitting on my knees right in front of her. She was sitting on a 5-gallon bucket. Sure did.
Isn't that amazing? You remind me of my grandmother in Tennessee. She raised 9 children on a small farm. My grandfather was legally blind, and he passed when I was 6 years old. My grandmother, raised 3 boys, my dad and his 2 brothers, and then she raised 6 girls. And she taught everybody to shoot. And the story in the family was when Grandma was about 80, past 80, a hawk, she called it a chicken hawk. Imagine it was a red-tailed hawk, was getting in her chickens, and it flew down and lit in a tree down there toward the creek. And she stood on the front porch with a .22 rifle and opened sights and killed that hawk, which, was probably not legal, but he was bothering Grandma's chickens, So coming from that kind of background, I can see that picture, Mark, of you there your mother at a dove field. You mentioned things there. It just, I try to to pick up on the culture of the areas that I go to. And being there in that part, is, you mentioned two things. You called the nut that's so popular down there a pecan. Some people them pecans.
Pecans, yes.
And you also mentioned a croaker sack, which is a burlap sack.
Burlap sack, yes, sir.
But you put, if you went frog gigging, you put your frogs in that sack. And I imagine that's where that name croaker sack came from, don't you think?
Possibly did. I did a lot of frog gigging.
Oh, yeah.
My father actually got one hound in his life, but bigger place. And he got it. They brought his hound come in on a train.
Mm-hmm.
And he went over and picked it up in a little town called, it's a community of his hound, but I don't think that hound amounted to much. And I was actually lured into coon hunting. My family owns a pretty nice piece of chunk of land.
Yeah, you know, tell us more about your family. Several. Feel free to discuss that.
That's right. My family owns, several thousand acres of land, all of us combined. And I had two friends that came hunted that were neighbors of mine. And to be honest, I think they were inviting me to go coon hunting. So, you know, they had better access to our property probably. But, but it got me started and I bought a hound. The first hound I think I bought, Nick Alverson let me hunt an old Walker hound. He had the pen. He said, ain't nobody hunting him. Just come get him and hunt him. And I mean, I could hunt a lot. I was probably an expert woodsman, but not a coon hunter. And he told me just to come get that dog, hunt it. And I hunted that dog a while. And then I bought a dog from James Ed Curtis, a young dog that just didn't pan out. And that started my journey. And over the years, I guess I lowered my standards and bought a hound. And he didn't pan out, I would lower my standards and buy another one. Of course, I was looking for the dog I saw in all the ads, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Never dreaming that I would have at least three hounds better than most of the dogs in those ads. But I was fortunate. Somewhere along the line, I met up with a dog named Ponte Dan. He's the one that, as far as for being a hunter, he's the one that.
Let's talk about Dan a little bit. Walker dog?
Yes, sir. He was a grandson out of Pac-Man. And actually, Russ Bella came all the way down to see him at a hunt. He wanted to buy him because he looked like Pac-Man and sounded almost exactly like Pac-Man from what people that hunted with that man, but he would find a way to win. He especially when he was a younger dog, as he got old, he got hunt wise, you know, a little bit hunt wise, but he found a way to win. He won me two back to back state championships and thousands upon thousands of dollars. And we'd go have a hunt back then, but I think they eliminated us from having them. But we'd have a cow cutter, and every time we went, Dan would always bring the most money because everybody knew he was going.
Yeah, the dog the money was on.
Yeah, when you pull up at a hunt and when you're walking in at a register and everybody looks up and said, are you going to try to hunt tonight or are you going to split? And I hadn't even entered the hunt yet. you know you're packing a pretty...
I got you.
A pretty powerful hound. I had another one like that at the end. Then Mr. Jimmy hunted it a good bit. He was a really rest. I was burned out from phone calls. you faced it. I don't have to explain it to you, but maybe some of these people. I was sitting with the proliferation of handheld cell phones. I was sitting at a restaurant in Albany. My wife and I went a few times, I wasn't hunting because when I did, I was dedicated to it. I mean, And I got a phone call from a cast in Troy, Alabama. I believe it was Troy. And they said, "Mark, we got a problem here in the woods, and we just want to talk to you about it." And I said, "Listen, you know, I'm supposed to be the guy that makes y'all play by the rules. You got to go back to the clubhouse and assemble a panel." And they said, "Yeah, we don't trust none of them." And everybody's agreed. Everybody's agreed that we can just tell you what happened on the phone. And everybody's agreed that whatever you
The head that wears the crown, Mark.
And over time, and I loved every one of those guys. You know. And even the ones I didn't like, I loved. If that makes any sense.
I understand. You respected what they did. You loved the activity that they were involved with. And
you know, they were people that always skirted the rules or stayed on the fence of them. And over time, you know, it was hard to like them. But I still, you know, gave them a chance. You know, I did. When a question come up, you know, I listened to them. But over time, all that stuff started to get to me a little bit, and I had kids growing up, and I won a lot with Dan. I had some other guys.
Talk about those dogs. Tell us about them.
I had a dog I bought from Cleve Ferguson in Texas.
Oh yeah, Jimmy and Cleve.
That's right. Cleve and I were good friends, and I think I actually wound up getting a dog from Eddie Muse. Eddie got him from Cleve on the way to me. And Eddie Muse hugged him a little bit. It's a blue English dog named Tick Tock Doc. And I remember it was a little bit of soreness there because he was the money leader in Texas. And I did a lot of winning with Doc. I tried to keep two pretty good hives. Then I had the Super Stakes champion and a reserve Super Stakes champion. One of them name was Prime Time Dick. He's a giant 90-something pound walker dog. And I bought him and brought him home and placed in the Winter Classic. I think it was in the open event he placed in it. And on the way home, the guy that was handling him was my first cousin. He said, "Mark," he said, "you know, I didn't see nothing, but I'm suspicious of that dog, that Dick dog." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, it was a female, had to cast one. And we got to the tree, she was off the tree and her nose was bleeding." And so we hadn't hunted him but a few days then. And we won Gideonville Plantation a few nights later, not far from where the Winter Classic was headquartered.
I've hunted out there off of Gillianville Highway in that American.
That's right.
That Southern Heritage plantation.
That's right.
There.
That's a nice place. Those places are great. I love to hunt them because it was open. It's rougher country up in where I'm at.
I got you.
More briars and bogs. But anyway, Dan, my lifetime favorite, was treed up on a hill, and the moon was kind of all come lumbering up there and just hopped right on him. And by the time my friend knocked me off of him, I was standing on his neck with a pistol to his head. I told him, I'm not going to have anything like that. And they talked me out of shooting him. And I know that's frowned upon now, but back then, as you well know, that happened a lot to mean dogs. But anyway, I wound up and sold him and got my money back. And then I bought a little dog named Forrest. He was, I think, the first 9 casts we hunted him in. He never scored less than 400 plus. He was a beautiful blanket back, big mouth walker dog that, if I had had the ambition, I feel sure I could have done great things with. But that was in that period of time that I was just running out of gas. I think actually I kept the Forrest dog and sold him to a friend of mine, and he hunted him up a little bit. And I think he won night champion or grand knight or something at the Winter Classic with mm-hmm. him a few weeks after I sold him. But I went through a lot more dogs than most of the, you know, most everybody you interviewed. I was a hunter. I wasn't really interested in breeding. And so I went through dogs until I found what I felt like I could win in the hunts with.
I got you.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that let's go into what I'm going to call the main event right here in this podcast. But let's lay a little bit of background. Your town or your where you were raised is how far from Plains, Georgia?
I'm right now where I'm standing. I'm about 6 miles from Plains.
Okay. I've driven up through that area and all. How far are you from Americus?
About 9 miles.
I gotcha. Well, this is kind of interesting, Mark, because yesterday I was talking to a young man, a coon hunter, and I'm not going to embarrass him. I'd say he's about 28 years old. And I asked him if he knew who Jimmy Carter was. And he said, no, I do not.
Yes, sir.
Most of my listeners are kind of long in the tooth like I am, or a lot of them are. We'll remember, of course, Jimmy Carter. He was the 39th president of the United States. He served from 19... He won a Nobel Prize for his humanitarian work back in 2002. And he was born, of course, in Plains, Georgia, October 1st of 1924. So that makes him 98 years old now. And we'll send out birthday wishes to President Carter, 98 years old. That's pretty amazing. My mother passed in March, and she made it to 100 years and 11 days. So I kind of got an idea, you know, of what that entails. And, of course, President Carter, or as you call him, Jimmy,
Mr. Jimmy,
was also the 76th governor of the state of Georgia from 71 to 75. So.
Yes, sir.
Or whatever your father's or however you want to approach it, Mark, about your association with the 39th president of the United States.
My father grew up with him at this, you know, the same time period. And, you know, even though it was probably where Mr. Jim and them's farm was when they were kids to where my family's farm is probably 6 miles, maybe seven. He went to a little small school right here in the community, but then eventually, you know, if he was going to go to high school, he had to go to Plains, and a lot of that was walking, you know. But he and Mr. Jimmy went to high school together, and as time wore on, you know, after the war, they did, you know, when Daddy come home, they did business together, and Mr. Jimmy had a buying point in Plains, and Amy was about the same age as I am, his youngest daughter. And when we sold peanuts to Mr. Jimmy's, you know, peanut buying point, and I actually, believe it or not, my picture was on the wall in his office. When I was 4 or 5 years old, somebody had me in a pair of overalls, and they got a picture that wound up, myself and my first cousin wound up on his wall. And I can remember as a child running in there and climbing up in his lap because I knew he was going to get me a 6 ounce Coca-Cola and dump those peanuts in it for me to.
That's another great Southern tradition right there.
That's right. I would climb in his lap, you know. And of course, my daddy would fuss, you know, and say, "Don't do that, Jimmy." But he would always get me a, you know, get a Coke and drink that Coca-Cola and try to catch them peanuts when they come out, you know. but you know, we just grew up here with him. And when he left, when he went to be inaugurated, my parents went to the governor's mansion. And when he went to be inaugurated and he forgot his mother, he came, he actually forgot his mother when he went to be inaugurated somehow or another, Miss Lillian. And he got the Secret Service to leave him at our house when he went, when it, you know, when they went back to get her. He's, you know, he stayed there with us while the Secret Service went back to pick up his mother. And I actually was in that old safe at the house, and I sent you a picture of a letter that he sent my father in 1977 when they were doing some farm negotiating. You know, it was, I think the farmers were threatening to strike then, and he wouldn't meet with a sensible person. And he wrote Daddy a letter thanking him for coming to calm people, you know, calm everything down. But I mean, it's a lifelong relationship, and he and I share, for his public politics, he and I share nothing, and nor my father. I mean, we're polar opposites on the politics, the political face he shows the public. But in private, we're, he's a lot, I won't go too far into that, but he's a lot more like we are. He's an old Southern Democrat at heart, but party politics has affected him as well.
Sure. Absolutely. I'm sure it would have to. Well, you know, it was pretty big news in the South, you know, to have a president. And of course, the media called him, you know, a peanut farmer. And like, you know, I don't imagine that was always a term of endearment, you know, if you're a New York Times reporter or whatever. But for the people in the heartland, I think they were proud that Jim, a man from Georgia, was president of the United States. And I think everybody said, regardless of whether they agreed with his politics or not, that he was basically a good man. And as I mentioned, earlier, you know, the Nobel Peace Prize, you know. So
it was somehow in politics, and I'm not saying that I'm unaffected by it myself, but about a year ago at the Capitol, I walked in and got surprised. I just went up there to talk to some politicians. They asked me to speak to them, and I told the Democrats in the Senate, I said, I pass people like me down the hall. There's nobody in this room like me. I don't agree with y'all's policies, but somehow or another, we've been lured into believing that you got to hate somebody because you don't. And Mr. Jimmy and I, there was a time when we were really close, and he knew that I stood way to the right of everything, you know, that he said in public. But he and I still had a wonderful time and a wonderful friendship. And we talked about a lot of things that I can't share, but a lot of things that I could. He never would tell me how deep a nuclear submarine would dive. I must have asked him 500 times.
Or as he would say, nuclear.
yeah. I'd surprise him, you know, and say, "Arn, how deep will a nuclear sub dive?" And he'd say, "I can't tell you that, Mark, but it's deep." I recall one particular hunt,
Let's do that. Before you jump into that, let's lay a little foundation for that. When did I know that you have coon hunted with Jimmy Carter.
Yes, sir.
And I imagine you're probably the first guy to take him coon hunting, maybe. Or do you think he hunted some when he was a boy?
As a president, I know I was.
Right. Okay.
But now I never asked him about coon hunting prior to. He just and you know, I had some notoriety. I'd done well in some hunts and I had some notoriety and he knew me well and I think he scuffled with the Secret Service a little bit about the security aspect of it. But
now, this was after he was retired. I mean, after his term, right?
That's right. Just this was probably, and I'm not good with years or dates, but I would say it was probably 30 years ago, 94, 93,
mm-hmm.
something like that. And he just out of the blue, he called me and said, "Mark, why don't you take me coon hunting?" I said, "Well, you just tell me when you're ready." And it started like that. And I think he was actually looking for, and I'm sure you will understand this, but I think he was looking for something to help him write about something.
Oh, uh-huh.
I don't think it, but I think later on he was endeared to it. A friend of mine, when I sort of retired from it, a friend of mine took him another time or two. He's actually a cousin of mine. That took him another maybe once or twice, but I think he was looking for material and experiences to write about. He conveyed something like that to me, but I can't remember exactly what his words were, but we went several times and I mean, we had a lot of fun, and eventually over time, snakes and water moccasins, you know, I'd say, well, we ain't gonna run up on no terrorist out here. I said, we might stumble up on an alligator or something, might have to beat him off of us or something. But you know, when speak that simple country and you could hear them over there discussing it, you know. But I tormented them. And I had it, and it'd just be wrong not to mention this one. I had a female that went with us. She actually works in counterfeit and fraud now, I think. But her name was Misty, and I called her Misty the Secret Service Lady. And she went with me more than once. She was working the night that he and I went coon hunting. And Misty the Secret Service Lady, I had her complete faith. You know, they'll tell you that they gonna give you some freedom, and then you look up and they slipping around, skittering around out there in the darkness, you know, trying to watch us. But over time, they eventually realized that they were just out of their element. And I told them, I said, the safest place he is with me right now. If we go to New York, I'll let y'all take over. and he and I got to share a lot of private time where he could be himself and I could be too.
Well, it was a special
time.
Yeah.
It was.
It had to be. And we're talking about the once leader of the free world, you know, the most powerful man in the world from between 1977 and 1981. He was the man. And, you know, and what I want you to do, I don't want to leave anything out. By the time you went, I think the first time you told me this story, I was just really fascinated by your description of what it was like to go on a coon hunt with a former president of the United States, with a Secret Service envoy there, or That's not the word I want. But anyway, with the, all
it
the
was
Secret
a convoy.
Service. Convoy. Okay. Well, just describe it a little bit, can you?
Well, I think the first time we went down on Pine Bloom Plantation, and Craig Hart was one of my, probably my closest hunting partner. And,
yeah.
And, well, there were several of them, but he was my next door neighbor. And his brother-in-law was a guide on Pine Bloom Plantation. And it's like 9 miles long and 4 miles wide, and a giant, you know, piece of property. And so we decided to take Mr. Jimmy down there. And that first trip, it, you know, you didn't see but maybe one Suburban and one car, you know, following us around. Of course, they never enter. I don't know how many people know this, but they aren't allowed to interact in any way. I mean, they are forbidden from conversation or any interaction with the president or the party he's with, unless that business is security or his well-being or his schedule. That's the only time they're allowed to intervene in anything. And the first night we went, you know, I could see that one Suburban and the one car, but they was cars and Suburbans. And I told them, I said, listen, you know, we can't tree a coon hiding in the bushes. And eventually I think we treed three or four coons that night, but I had a dog, I had Pine Creek Dan, and I had a dog named Forrest, who I really hate to admit it. He was out of a dog called Mercy Creek Tom, a man named Frank Granberry on Mercy Creek Tom. Mm-hmm. And I hunted with Tom a lot of nights, and I never liked Mercy Creek Tom, but if I'm not mistaken, he threw two or three world champions. He was a really good reproducer. Mm-hmm. And this forest dog was one of the best dogs that I ever hunted with or owned. And by a long shot, it was just a shame that my career in coon hunt was waning when I acquired him. But anyway, it was Dan and Forrest, and of course, Mr. Jimmy, he liked Forrest, I think, because of the similarity with Forrest and Forrest Gump. I would give him a pair of snake proof waders that I had Paul Sheffield specially built my waders. I would take a pair of Rocky boots, just regular old Rocky, and he would sew me the wader tops on.
Right.
And the first pair or so, we had a lot of trouble getting them to waterproof at that seam, you know, where they sewed
right.
the tops on.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually, you know, we solved it. And to this day, I don't understand why somebody isn't making them now. But I always kept two or three pair around. And Mr. Jimmy, I would give him a light and, Basil Kittle made my lights back then, Bandit.
Right.
Bandit lights. And I would give him a Bandit light and a pair of waders, and he would dress up just like a real live coon hunter. And we'd go to the woods. And we talked about everything under the sun, a little bit of politics and mostly life lessons. But it was a special time. Probably the third time we went to Pine Bloom, or the second time maybe, there was an agent that was off duty, and he wasn't working that night, but he grew up coon hunting with his grandfather in Louisiana. And I'm one of those people, they're just not many people that I hold, or probably nobody that I hold in awe or
right.
I have respect, but I don't really look up to anyone. And So one of those agents eased up to me while Mr. Jimmy was in there doing a tour in the carriage house. You know, they were looking at the quail hunting buggies, you know. And that agent eased up to me and he said, Mark, he said, I got a guy, you know, he's attached to Mr. Jimmy, or the President Carter is what they call him. He said, but he's off duty and he went coon hunting with his grandfather as a child. And his grandfather's passed away and he hadn't been able to experience anything like that in several years. And he'd like to go along. He says he won't participate in the hunt and he'll stay out of sight. He just wants to hear those dogs. And I told him, I said, come, you know, the guy had pulled up. I said, come with me. And we walked over where Mr. Jimmy was and you know this agent right here. And he said, sure I do. I said, he's my guest tonight. And, just as much as you are, I said, you know, I believe all men are, you know, are equal. And I said, tonight he's going to be a part of this hunt just like you are on equal foot. I know he's attached to you and I know y'all got rules, but he's not working tonight and he wants to go coon hunt. So he's going to be my guest as well. Of course, Mr. Jimmy looked up at me like I was crazy. And he said, that ain't no big deal. Ain't no big deal at all. And I think that endeared a lot of those Secret Service agents that heard that exchange, you know, between he and I. And of course, that guy went and a few weeks later, he brought me some Secret Service coin, you know, some gold Secret Service coin. He was so taken by it, but probably an experience that he would have never had. I had one other experience with it was Misty, the Secret Service lady, and this giant guy. He was about 6'8" or 6'9". He was an agent as well. And it was about this time of the year. And Mr. Jimmy wanted to go and I got a certain amount of enjoyment out of pulling up that security gate and blowing the horn, you know, in an old pickup truck with a dog box in the back. And of course, they'd ask me to state my business and I'd say, man, open that gate. Me and Mr. Jimmy's fixing to go coon hunt. And I'm sure it was a certain amount of disgust to some of them, but I would kind of make their business plain, you know, everyday stuff and say, man, we're going to go coon hunt and open this gate. And I went and picked Mr. Jimmy up, and that night only Misty and the big guy went. I had never met this guy. He's from New York. And we flipped Dan out in a gum swamp down there where you're talking about around Albany. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. They got cypress ponds and the creeks are sandy with hard bottoms. Up here it's gum swamps and you wade in everything up to your knees in mud. Yeah. And Mr. Jimmy had brought his grandkids, about 3 or 4 grandkids. I flipped Dan out by himself and he went that right smack dab in the middle of that gum swamp and treed a coon. And I told Mr. Jimmy, I said, you know, just let me walk out there because, you know, it's that old grass with those tussocks in it. Yeah. There'd be water moccasins laying up on them. And you walk through that knee deep in water, you know, and you above the snake proof part of that wader. I said, what about just letting me walk out there and look and see if he's got a coon? If he does, we'll get up, a couple of us, and we'll tote those kids out there. So I took off and was wading out, and I heard something splashing behind me. And I turned around and looked back. Mr. Jimmy and a line of grandkids was right behind me. And those kids were waist deep in the water, you know. And, of course, I looked back, and this big guy, he's about 6'7" or 6'8", might have been 6 long, with a mag light holding it straight up over his head at arm's length, trying to keep that light on Mr. Jimmy. I stopped what I was doing and went around Mr. Jimmy and I told him, I said, I'm going to tell you what you better do. I said, you better take that light and watch where you're going. I said, Mr. Jimmy's got a light and he's right there with me and he's going to be okay, but you're going to fall on something that'll stick you out here. you know, better look where you're going. And we saw that coon and left. He was standing there with his mag light, you know, playing with the coon. And Mr. Jimmy and I just turned around and walked off with our, you know, he had hunted with me enough then that, you know, it was, he had become used to it. And he and I walked off and we're having our conversation about whatever it was at that time. And he come running through those woods with that mag light at arm's length above his head, which that was he was a big guy. It looked like a TV tower light or something. But he come running that spring head about 6 foot deep and about 6 foot across. And he was not running wide open, but he was in a good fast run when he went off in that ditch, and his face hit the other side of that wall. And honestly, I don't know how it didn't break his back. And I told Mr. Jimmy, I said, excuse me a minute, Mr. Jimmy. And I turned around and walked back that ditch, and he was pushing himself back up to get on his feet. And I leaned over in that ditch and looked at him. I said, I told you the best thing for you to do is take that light and make sure you see where you're going with it. I got Mr. Jimmy. He looked up at me out of that ditch, his face and his head was covered with dirt. He looked up at me and he said, you right, boss. I'm going to look where I'm going from now on. And that was the reason why I think he just never was working the nights.
I got you.
But we had a lot of talks and about a lot of subjects.
Well, let me interrupt you real quick. I think the interesting thing about that story is how that coon so fascinated that Secret Service agent that he let you and the president walk off and didn't realize it while he was mesmerized by that raccoon in the tree.
I think he was from New York City, and it was so far that nothing like that, I'm sure, had ever occurred in his life, nor did he ever, probably didn't desire to experience it or ever even think of that experience occurring.
But, for sure.
We went a lot of times, and Craig Hart and myself and Michael Feltman. And there's a picture. I didn't take enough pictures, Mr. Steve. I'm so sick of time. I should have took a lot more pictures, but there's one picture of that I use sometimes, my profile picture on Facebook. And it's myself and Mr. Jimmy, Craig Hart, Riley Etchell, and Michael Feltman. And when I took that picture and looked at it, a Secret Service agent took it for us, but I would have never dreamed that Mr. Jimmy and I are the only two of that hunting party left alive. Everybody else is the dogs, Craig Hart, Michael Feltman, and Riley Etchell, all are deceased. And they were a lot closer to my age than they were Mr. Jimmy's. I never dreamed that Mr. Jimmy and I would be the only two left alive.
Do you recall, without, you know, getting too personal, some of the conversations that you and Jimmy had? One of the things, that he have questions about the dogs? What are the dogs doing? And which one is that? And was he interested in that at all?
The first few drops, he would say, which one's that? And I say, that's Dan. And Dan sounded like he was fussing the whole time. He had a big ball mouth and he bawled on the tree. And Forrest had a little bit deeper voice, and it was huge as well. And they were so easy to tell what they were. Yeah. I mean, it was so easy to call. And Forrest was a ball mouth tree dog too. But I mean, both of them would hit with a giant locate, and I mean, it sounds like I'm right. I mean, when either one of those hounds, and everybody that knows me knows I wouldn't own one that wasn't real. And when either one of them, when they located, that was it, and they didn't move. Mm-hmm. Literally would not move.
Right.
And so it was pretty easy, except, you know, on a dry night when it was really dry, or coons weren't moving and they were working out old tracks or something. You know, so it was a lot of times it was hard for me to tell what was going on.
Yeah.
Then,
but, sure.
But it was, he had some fascination with it. And every time we'd go hunting, he'd write me a letter. And actually my first cousin's his personal secretary. And I asked her, I said, how many of them things is he auto pen? And she said, I don't let him auto pen nothing. I don't like stuff not being genuine. But every time we'd go coon hunting, he'd write me a letter, or he'd written some books, and he would inscribe, you know, the inside the cover of that book and write, you know, a pretty lengthy letter about some of the experiences that night. And I probably should have prepared myself for this a little better by going back and reading some of those inscriptions or some of the letters. But
we'll have to do that on another episode, Mark.
That's
right. We can definitely do that.
Those things, I get them in the mail, and I knew, and I was roadshow. And it was a guy in there that had a letter from, I think it was from Eisenhower, that Eisenhower had written his father.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the things that they used in that, and when they were valuing that letter, was personal experience. And did Eisenhower actually know, you know, the person he was writing the letter to? And it was like 3,000 or 4,000. And then all of a sudden, I mean, this was, you know, 30 years ago. And they said that letter was worth $30,000, $25,000, or $30,000. And I jumped up and went to run around the house gathering up all those letters. He wrote me and poked them in the safe then. I said, well, maybe one day my kids can sell them or something and get some money out of it. I doubt they would. But every one of them, I was sitting there thinking, and every letter he wrote me, it showed an activity we had together. And, you know, I didn't realize it at the time, but he knew he was doing me a favor. And I was sitting there saying, he called me on the phone and told me that. I don't know why he keep writing, you know, letters, because he had my cell phone number and I had his at that time. He could just call me, and he kept writing those letters. And I didn't realize what he was doing until after I saw that episode of the Antique Roadshow. The first time that he went with me was he requested to go hunting with me, and it gave him some freedom. I made sure that he had some freedom, and I don't think most people understand just how compromised someone in his position's private life is. I mean, they're in the bathroom with you there everywhere you go. But after he went that first time, he had a ball, and I made sure he did. And we joked and laughed and talked about a lot of things that I wouldn't feel comfortable saying, and you know, because of his privacy. But we had a lot of fun. And then eventually, every time I went, because back then I went, you know, almost every night, But probably once every other week. Of course, he had engagements all over the world. You know, at that time, he was still out and about. And I would know where he was gone. But when I saw the opportunity, you know, he'd say, well, you know, I'm fixing to go here, but I'll be back in a week. And then I'm going to have 2 weeks at home. And I'd say, okay. And I'd call him, you know, tell me what night you want to go. And we'd make a trip. You know, I was going anyway, but we would try to make it easier. You know, he was in his 70s then, probably in his 70s. And I would try to take him somewhere well, it was easy a walk and not so many briars and gum swamps. You know, I'd taken where the creek bottoms was hard. But also, I think one of the reasons or what endeared him to me in hunting was, is I made absolutely sure, and I touched on this a little bit while ago, but I have a moderate amount of disgust for idolizing people. And I made sure that he was treated no differently than anybody else in that hunting party. Now, if something arose, then I would have done anything to keep him out of danger myself. But I made sure he pulled his weight and he was treated like a normal person. We joked and laughed, and I didn't treat him like he was the president of the United States. Hmm. And I think he enjoyed and appreciated that. And as the trust built, you know, every time I'd go when they were new Secret Servicemen, I would tease them a lot about alligators and snakes. And then I'd say, you know, I mentioned this before, I'd say, when he's out here, he's safest with me. If we go to New York, I'm going to turn him over to y'all. But right now, the best thing happened to Mr. Jimmy. I mean, y'all just here working. I grew up with him, and I'd have to live in this community without him. And he's a draw to a lot. He's a draw to a lot of these businesses here. You know, little cottage businesses that popped up. And I said, I can't pull up in planes and say I let Mr. Jimmy get snake bit last night. You know, and I said, so I'm gonna take care of him.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that angle, but you were taking risks for sure when you.
That's right. But it's time. It's time won my trust in some of, especially like Misty, that grew up in Louisiana. They, you know, I gained their trust, and I carried a pistol with me everywhere I went. And nobody ever said a word. But eventually, it gave Mr. Jimmy and I time. You know, after maybe the third trip or so, we could slip away, and it just, you know, it'd just be he and I.
Yeah.
And they, you know, I mean, they might be 300 yards or 400 yards away, but some, you know, it gave us privacy, and it gave him a chance to be himself and not feel pressured by presences of people.
Sure.
It was just, and we had a lot of private and personal conversations. We talked about a lot of things, but most of it, most of our conversations revolved around small town stuff that really didn't interest people. And
you know, it's absolutely a fantastic story to me just to think that you took the president of the United States.
I took him a lot of times.
Yeah,
we had good hunt. We had a lot of fun. And it means a lot to me now. I never thought about it coming to an end.
Yeah.
You know, really, I never realized we'd run out of time, and I just want to go shake his hand and tell him that I enjoyed mine and his time together in life, you know, that it was special. And
well, Mark, when we started on this journey here on this podcast, I didn't realize we were going to have some cantankerous recorder here, and this is a new one and a replacement. So I don't know if I talk so much and I wear these things out. I don't know what the problem is, but at any rate, we were talking about you and President Jimmy Carter, and I asked you, did he usually call you when the two of you would go coon hunting, and you responded to that, and then I think that you wanted to expound on that just a little bit and then get into something that you said you'd like for us to cover.
Right. He Mr. Jimmy did ask me the first time. He called me, and you know, I had a moderate amount of notoriety at that time for being a coon hunter, and he did call me and ask me, and from that point on, you know, it just kind of turned into he and I being coon hunting buddies. But, you know, he was still active and he had engagements, and eventually I learned his schedule, and he would call me and say, I'm going to be here for a week or 2 weeks, and then I'll have a week at home. And I would call him, you know, on the weeks he was home and just say, all right, Mr. Jimmy, you know, I go every night. You tell me when you want to go. And we tried to pick places when he went that had a few more coons, and the hunting was a little bit easier. But one of the things that I did, and it was important to me, and I think it endeared Mr. Jimmy to me, was I made sure that he was treated like an average person. I made sure he pulled his own weight, and I wouldn't allow him to get in any danger, but I made sure that he was treated just like anybody else in the hunting party. And I think he enjoyed that. And as time passed, you know, it become more of a routine with the Secret Service men that were attached to him, and we began to get more freedom, and it gave he and I a time, you know, some time alone to talk about things. Most of it was local things, you know, or things when I was younger. And I think he enjoyed the privacy. I don't think people realize how intrusive having Secret Service agents attached to your ears. I probably couldn't stand it.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But we built a special relationship because he could be normal again. And I made sure I gave him that opportunity. And I think he loved me for it.
Yeah, I'm sure he appreciated that very much. Yeah. Very. Okay, Mark, we've been at this over an hour, and it's a terrific story, one that I've wanted to record for a long time. And I do appreciate so much you being willing to come on and to share your relationship. And I know, as you know, the cycle of life winds down, and Mr. Carter at 98 years old is obviously just not going to be with us that much longer. But it's a great story, and I'm sure one of our listeners appreciate. Now, you told me that you had something you wanted to share before we go.
I do. It's not much. I just wanted to kind of shout out to my friends, Buzz Register, Nick Alverson, Steve Parrish, Dennis Griffin, Gary Elliott, and a million more of them, and say it was an honor to travel through time with that group of men.
Yes.
It was. I wouldn't trade my experiences with those people for anything. Right. You know, you don't really realize it, but we all traveling through time together, and I wouldn't trade my experiences with those people and our times together for anything in the world. It was one of the best times in my life. And they were part of the reason. And there's more than those people. You know, so a lot of them are deceased now. Paul Sheffield, Craig Hart, Johnny Gosar, Woody McCorkle. There's a lot of them that are deceased. And I missed a lot of live ones too. But those were my closest. That was my few. And I just want to make sure they know I loved it.
Sure.
And them.
Absolutely.
They were good to me.
Sure. Well, I'm sure, and they felt the same way about you, Mark. And that's a sentiment that we should all think about. We should all think about the people involved in this sport that have made it so great for us all to enjoy. Mark Israel, it has been an absolute delight to have you on the program this week. I know our listeners are going to love your stories. And I hope that I can get that commitment from you to come back on. I know you're a busy, busy man, and I'm sure it'll take you a long time to answer all the calls and texts and everything that have accumulated while we've spent this hour and a half or whatever. But, buddy, thank you so much for coming on. I do appreciate it. And
hey, it was an honor to be asked by you. It was a lot of famous people you've interviewed, and to even be considered to be a guest among those people and by you. I said it before and I'll say it again. You're the only one. And I mean, there've been a few people that came and went, but you're the only one that stood the test of time. And you're an icon in this business.
Well,
I don't say things I don't mean. It's an honor to be invited to be a guest. I wouldn't know why anybody would want to hear anything I had to say.
Oh, but I'll assure you that they've enjoyed this week. And you know, Mark, we all, I think, tend to think that way, but we all have a story. And that story's worth telling of a wife of a life well lived, and a life entwined with coon hunting and coon hunters and hounds and all that. It's been a very special life for me, and I know it has been for you. And we're just blessed, aren't we, brother?
Yes, sir. I agree.
Well, Mark, I have a way of closing this thing out all the time, and my listeners know where this is going. If anyone asks you where this old coon hunter, this old worn-out coon hunter with a million miles or more on him, where is he? Where has he gone? Well, the answer is simple. He's gone to the dogs.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
President's Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th, U.S. only. See store online for details.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.